Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Updates. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the arrest of former Lake County Councilman Jamal Washington, the land-based casino proposal could be a big win for the city of Gary, Brandon Smith reports on the redistricting standards bill approved by a Senate panel on Monday, and Chris Nolte has a conversation with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Updates. Despite objections from legal counsel, the city council voted to bar ex-Lake County Councilman Jamal Washington from meetings after allegations he battered political ally and Gary Councilwoman LaVita Sparks-Wade in her home last week. Gary Council President Ron Brewer made a motion banning Washington from city council and committee meetings. Washington remains in police custody pending a police investigation, and as Porter County probation officials move to revoke his probation at the request of a special prosecutor in his most recent conviction. Six members voted yes, while two, Councilman-at-Large Herbert Smith and Councilwoman Linda Barnes, abstained amid legality concerns. Attorney Renzer Williams suggested they table the motion for a private discussion due to possible litigation. After the meeting, Williams told the Times that Sparks, Wade, and Brewer clarified later that a restraining order has been filed against Washington and that the council's vote was merely a recognition of Sparks, Wade's order. For years, Sparks Wade has been unwavering in her support for Washington through his domestic violence convictions, going so far as to favorably testify on his behalf late last year when he faced a jury trial for battering a 24-year-old female cousin. She described Washington as her live-in boyfriend when police responded to her home to check on her welfare. On Tuesday night, she spoke about her experience as a domestic abuse survivor and asked people to refrain from victim shaming. She received applause from many in the audience. Sparks Wade encouraged victims to call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233. Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson thanked Sparks Wade for her candor and transparency in speaking about the alleged abuse. Jamal Washington, 45, was formally charged last Friday with five felony counts related to criminal confinement, domestic battery, and intimidation in an incident involving Sparks Wade, who is running for Gary Mayor. Sparks Wade told police January 30th that Washington threatened to kill her and in a fit of rage battered her and held her against her will in her home. According to court records, he is accused of holding her against her will in her home for nearly 16 hours until shortly before 8 a.m. last Wednesday when she escaped their bedroom and texted her friend, a Lake County Sheriff's officer, for help. The fight reportedly broke out over Sparks Wade's choice for a campaign manager. However, the abuse had begun weeks earlier. Sparks Wade said she didn't report him to authorities then, but on December 13th, he allegedly smacked her face with an open hand and threatened to stab her in the neck. 5 days later, Porter Superior Court Judge Jeffrey Thode sentenced Washington in connection with his conviction for battering a female cousin to 180 days at the Lake County Jail, but suspended all but time already served to be spent on unsupervised probation. A hearing is not yet scheduled to review Washington's probation revocation. If the hearing is not set before Washington's 15-day hold in jail expires, Carter said Lake County prosecutors will move to increase Washington's bond.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Spectacle Entertainment unveiled plans Wednesday to construct a $300 million boutique casino, including a 200-room hotel along the Borman Expressway in Gary, if the General Assembly permits the Majestic Star to move off its Lake Michigan dock. The Times reports John Keeler, Spectacle General Counsel, told a Senate committee that a Gary land-based casino could generate $75 million annually in net new revenue for the state and create 400 jobs at the new location, growing Majestic's current workforce by one half. That requires, however, the legislature to approve a sprawling game proposal that, in addition to relocating the Gary Casino inland, would send the second Gary Casino license to Terre Haute without any payment to Gary. legalize sports wagering statewide, eliminate casino ownership caps, and alter some gaming tax distributions. Senate Bill 552 was unanimously approved by the Senate Public Policy Committee following more than 3 hours of public testimony, many from Northwest Indiana, both supporting and opposing the legislation. It now goes to the Senate Appropriations Committee for a closer look at the measure's impact on state revenue. State Senator Ron Alting, the Public Policy Committee chairman, said the legislation is, quote, one of the biggest gaming bills maybe in the history of Indiana, with the exception of the very first one that brought gaming to Indiana. While Gary officials said they are excited by the development opportunities associated with a land-based casino located at an I-80-94 exit, they emphasized that the casino move simply is a necessary part of their larger plans to transform the casino current site at Buffington Harbor into a multimodal shipping hub. Those plans call for using a Lake Michigan port as well as an adjacent freight rail terminal, the city's interstate highway access, and nearby airport to entice shippers to bypass the crowded Chicago rail yards and instead transfer and warehouse their products in Gary. State Senator Eddie Melton noted the benefits of the casino move and multimodal development will accumulate not only in Gary but also help improve the economy and quality of life throughout Northwest Indiana. Leaders of the region organizations representing many of the businesses and workers that would construct the new casino and multimodal project told the committee they're on board. On the other hand, city leaders and public safety officials from Hammond and East Chicago told the committee the proposal only helps Gary at the expense of their communities. Both Hammond Mayor Thomas McDermott Jr. and East Chicago Mayor Anthony Copeland said, unlike Gary, they've wisely spent and invested their gaming tax revenue on city amenities and programs that have made both cities attractive places to live. They said permitting the Majestic Star to move to a more accessible location compared to their casinos on Lake Michigan will sharply reduce revenue in both cities, a significant part of which is dedicated to public safety. A committee-adopted amendment to the legislation would ensure that Hammond receives no less gaming tax revenue following a Gary casino relocation than it takes in during the 2019 budget year. The sponsor of the legislation, State Senator Mark Messmer, promised to also provide East Chicago with, quote, hold harmless protections. But McDermott pointed out that preserving revenue for local governments doesn't help the Horseshoe or Ameristar casinos if a new land-based casino attracts their players and wagers.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Police are seeking the public's help in finding vandals who caused $80,000 in damage to a religious shrine in Lake County. St. John police say 20 granite light and speaker posts at the Shrine of Christ Passion were pulled apart and their lighting fixtures were smashed in late December. The damage totaled about $80,000. Police Commander Steve Flores says the vandalism occurred between December 24th and December 26th when it was discovered. Security cameras captured images of the vandals, but police said the image quality was relatively poor. The department posted those images last week on its Facebook page asking anyone who has information to contact the department. The Times reports the popular shrine opened in 2008 and features scenes depicting the final days of Jesus' life.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
NIPSCO is planning 3 wind farms in an effort to gradually shift from coal-fired power to renewable energy. The Maryville-based utility announced Friday that the wind farms would be in Benton, Montgomery, Warren, and White counties and have nearly 300 turbines, helping it move toward a goal of being coal-free by late 2028. The Times reports the projects involve partnerships between the utility and private companies. NIPSCO has asked state regulators to approve the wind farms, which it expects to be in operation by late 2020. The utility serves about 460,000 electricity customers and 820,000 natural gas customers across 32 counties.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Energy giant BP says it doesn't have a timeline for repairs to a crude distillation unit that shut down after a fire at its Indiana refinery. The Times reports that a recent fire caused a malfunction to the unit at BP's Whiting refinery. The unit helps transform crude oil into gasoline and other fuels. It operates at a rate of 75,000 barrels per day. BP is still operating two other crude distillation units at the 430,000 barrel per day refinery. BP didn't comment on how the temporary shutdown would affect production. The refinery is the largest in the Midwest and supplies gasoline to seven states. It produces 10 million gallons of gasoline, 3.5 million gallons of diesel, and 1.7 million gallons of jet fuel a day.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Appeals Court says a judge exceeded his authority by doubling a woman's prison sentence to 6 years after she failed to timely surrender to authorities to start her term. Porter Superior Judge Robert Bradford initially sentenced 36-year-old Hakima Qualls of Gary to 3 years in prison. She was charged with escape, battery, and driving while intoxicated. The Times reports Bradford ordered her to report to jail last March, but she requested more time to get her affairs in order. Bradford granted that request. But when Qualls' attorney sought even more time, she was sentenced to 6 years in prison. In a 3-0 decision Thursday, the appeals court said the judge was wrong to increase Qualls' original sentence.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A legislative panel is backing tougher penalties for drivers who pass stopped school buses after members heard from relatives of three children fatally struck while crossing a northern Indiana highway. An Indiana Senate committee voted unanimously Wednesday to endorse a bill that would suspend the driver's license for 90 days the first time someone recklessly passes a stopped school bus. It would allow $1,000 fines against repeat offenders recorded by school bus cameras. Michael Stahl told the committee he believed tougher penalties might deter some drivers from passing buses. Stahl's 9-year-old daughter and her twin 6-year-old half-brothers were killed in the October 30th pre-dawn collision on Indiana 25 near Rochester. The driver who hit the children told authorities she didn't realize she was approaching a stopped school bus.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill wants the U.S. Supreme Court to rule on a lawsuit over a state abortion law. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports that's as the nation's high court is already considering whether to take on another Indiana abortion case.
A 2016 Indiana abortion law required women to wait at least 18 hours between an ultrasound and their abortion, essentially to prompt second thoughts about terminating the pregnancy. Planned Parenthood sued, arguing the 18-hour waiting period put an undue burden on women. A federal district judge and the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals agreed and halted the law. Now, Attorney General Curtis Hill wants the U.S. Supreme Court to weigh in. Many conservative groups hope the court's new makeup will be more favorable to upholding anti-abortion legislation. Hill also previously asked the Supreme Court to rule on other parts of the 2016 law, one provision that banned abortions performed because of a fetus's characteristics, and another that required healthcare facilities to bury or cremate fetal remains. The court hasn't decided whether to take that case. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Proposed legislation would allow incarcerated parents to maintain a more meaningful role in their child's life. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on the bill.
Indiana has one of the highest rates of incarcerated parents. The emotional and physical health impact on children whose parents are in prison can be lasting. Democrat Representative Carly Macer authored new legislation.
It allows the court to consider whether the parent continues to play a meaningful role in the child's life.
The legislation would allow parents to appear in court to discuss the case involving their child. It would also give judges more flexibility to determine if termination of parental rights after a certain period of time is warranted or not. The bill passed the committee unanimously. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana lawmakers are moving reluctantly to scale back labeling requirements for manufacturers of substances used in vaping called e-liquids. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on legislation prompted by federal regulations.
The General Assembly created regulations for e-liquid manufacturers and retailers in 2017, such as requiring tamper-proof packaging and labeling. Now, proposed legislation would eliminate some of the labeling requirements. That includes scrapping a rule that every e-liquid container have an identifiable, trackable product code. Michael Wilson sells vaping supplies. He says the code is a useful tool.
Especially as a small business owner, having a permit number right there to ensure compliance, that we know what we're putting on our shelf is compliant.
Republican Senator Randy Head agrees. He wrote the 2017 bill, and he's the author of this year's measure, too. He says new federal rules limit what individual states can require of e-liquid manufacturers.
Those were important when we wrote that bill. I argued at the time that they were necessary, and I still wish that they could be there, but they can't.
Head's bill easily cleared the Senate Public Policy Committee. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
More than 200 local volunteers with a national gun safety advocacy group lobbied at the State House Tuesday. Moms Demand Action Indiana asked lawmakers to strengthen firearm storage laws. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Carter Barrett reports.
The red shirts of over 200 volunteers flooded State House hallways Tuesday. Advocates included students and parents affected by the shooting at Noblesville West Middle School and the mother of a four-year-old who fatally shot himself after a babysitter left a loaded firearm unattended. Moms Demand leader Rachel Guglielmo says this is the most volunteers they've ever had at the State House. She says Hoosiers are responding to Indiana's two school shootings last year.
I think it's a reflection of the growing concern in our state about gun violence and the growing determination of ordinary people to do something about it.
There are over two dozen school safety-related bills in the legislature this session, some filed in direct response to the Noblesville shooting. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Carter Barrett.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Traditional public schools might have to split their voter-approved referenda funding with nearby charter schools under a bill in the House. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports the proposal was met with concerns from some lawmakers and public school advocates at a hearing Wednesday.
Most school corporations have not asked voters for a tax hike to boost their funding, but House Education Committee Chair Bob Boehning is proposing a bill so any district that passes a funding referendum has to share those dollars with local charter schools. Boehning says the goal is to improve equity in charter school funding, but J.T. Koopman from the Association of Public School Superintendents says it's another way to move money out of already struggling districts.
As a matter of fact, it could have a negative effect on public schools when you have public school proponents that realize their hard work siphoned dollars away from their public schools.
The bill also lowers the wait time for schools to sell unused buildings from 2 years to 90 days. The committee will vote on the bill next week. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A Senate panel approved a bill Monday that once again tries to impose some standards on lawmakers when they redraw the state's legislative district boundaries. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports a similar bill failed last year, and like last year, many advocates want it to do more.
Some of the bill's language says legislators should try to keep intact cities, communities, and neighborhoods when drawing new maps, and it says incumbent lawmakers' addresses shouldn't be considered. Redistricting reform advocacy groups have long called for a bigger step, an independent redistricting commission to draw Indiana's maps. High school student and a member of one of those groups, Christian Amari, says failing that, the bill, which advocates support, can still be stronger.
Expressly stipulating that districts cannot be drawn for partisan advantage.
Republican Senator Aaron Houchin doesn't like the bill and voted against it.
I'm not opposed to the standards, but this bill assumes that we can't draw fair maps.
Other state legislatures have recently had to redraw maps because courts said they were drawn for political gain. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
This lawmaking session could see changes in alcohol rules at Indiana restaurants and grocery stores. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports a House committee this week heard more than an hour of testimony from stakeholders on a bill that makes dozens of changes to Indiana's alcohol laws.
Some provisions affect grocery stores. Clerks would have to be at least 21 years old and go through training to ring up alcohol. And the stores would have to keep all of their alcohol confined to one area. Grant Monahan lobbies for grocery stores, which oppose that provision.
No one knows better how to merchandise a retail store other than retailers. And retailers do a very good job of that, always with the customer in mind.
The bill also allows restaurants to let their customers bring in outside bottles of wine for a fee set by the restaurants. But restaurant owner Kelly Ford doesn't like that idea. She says she'll feel forced into doing so by her competitors.
This hurts my profits.
The House committee will consider amendments and vote on the bill next week. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A trustee on the board of the Evansville Vanderburgh Public Library has lost her seat amid controversy over a library event that will feature drag queens and kings reading to children. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Isaiah Seibert reports the Vanderburgh County Council declined to reappoint Barbara Williams.
Library trustees serve four-year terms. Williams was at the end of hers, and instead of reappointing her, all but one council member voted to appoint Richard Clements in her place. Councilman Tom Shetler says Drag Queen Story Hour revealed the board hasn't been doing its job. Shetler believes the new appointee will hold the library more accountable. As for the Story Hour,
I think he's going to look at it in a very sound, reasonable way, and he's going to weigh it all out.
Councilwoman Stephanie Terry was the only one to vote against Clement's nomination. She said during the meeting that she had nothing against the nominee, but
not reappointing Barbara Williams is a great loss to the EVPL board. She was one of the most qualified trustees that they had. Good things were happening at the library, and I believe that it's due in part to some of Barbara's contributions.
Williams couldn't be reached for comments. The Story Hour is scheduled for later this month. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Isaiah Seibert.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A bill to modernize Indiana laws related to HIV was heard by lawmakers Wednesday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports the proposal would update laws to reflect current science and medicine.
Indiana laws related to the transmission of HIV were written in the 90s. IUPUI Associate Professor Dr. Carrie Foote leads Indiana's HIV modernization movement. She's lived with the virus for 20 years.
But thanks to the advances in modern medicine, I am here today with a very successful career, and my husband and teenage son do not have HIV.
The bill removes stigmatized legal language, changes penalties, and updates duty to warn laws. Dr. Bree Weaver, HIV expert at IU School of Medicine, says people don't get tested for fear of prosecution.
Outdated and stigmatizing laws are negatively affecting our ability to bring people with HIV into care, and thereby to bring the HIV epidemic to an end.
Amendments will be made to the bill before a committee vote. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A panel of House lawmakers unanimously approved legislation Wednesday that would allow guns in churches and on school grounds. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the committee also changed parts of the bill that relate to gun licenses.
The House committee took hours of testimony on the bill last week, but it didn't debate the measure at all before voting on it this week. The bill would allow property owners, whether it's a house of worship or a school, to decide whether churchgoers can carry guns at a service. The measure also originally eliminated the fee for a lifetime handgun license, but the bill's author, Republican Committee Chair Ben Smaltz, changed it. Now, fees for short-term handgun licenses would be eliminated. Republican Representative Jim Lucas supports the change, though he wants it to go further.
I still think that requiring a license of a constitutional right is unconstitutional, but since the chairman is doing such a good job moving in that direction, I want to throw a bone and show some support, and I'm going to vote yes.
The legislation also changes the period of those short-term licenses from 4 years to five. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana's preschool program could grow to serve every county this year. Education Committee Chair Bob Beening is backing a bill that will expand the state's On My Way to Pre-K program to the entire state. Right now, only preschool providers in 20 counties with a level 3 rating or higher on the state's PAFSA quality system can qualify. But Beening's bill would change the location limits for eligible providers.
We're still keeping the quality at level 3 or 4, but we're no longer saying it has to be in those 20 counties. This is now available statewide.
Early childhood education advocates pressed lawmakers to make the move leading up to this year's session. Representative Jim Lucas, a fellow Republican on the committee, says he's concerned about a potential increase in costs, especially those passed along to taxpayers. But an analysis by the Legislative Services Agency says what the state already set aside to fund the program, $22 million a year, should be enough to cover the expansion. CEO of the nonprofit Early Learning Indiana, Maureen Weber, says it's also just worth more investment, especially as more studies point to the benefits of high-quality programs.
You're going to see opportunities for them to be developing language and literacy skills, numeracy skills as well, and then, you know, working on social, emotional, and other kinds of skills as well.
An economic impact report released last fall says Indiana loses more than $1 billion annually because of families' inadequate access to early childhood education programs. The committee plans to vote on the bill next week.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Two professors are tackling what they call a, quote, wicked problem, helping children cope with violence. Dr. Wanda Thruston and Dr. Barb Pierce teach at Indiana University Purdue University, Indianapolis. In an interview with Side Effects Public Media's Araceli Gomez-Saldana, they spoke about the project and how it will affect students, teachers, and parents.
Dr. Thruston, Dr. Pierce, thank you for joining us. First, can you explain what a wicked problem is?
So a wicked problem is a problem that is kind of intractable or kind of really hard to cope with.
It's severe and persistent exposure to violence, and maybe violence that they see within their families, within their communities, or they experience themselves. It could be just disruption in their home. A parent gets incarcerated, domestic violence, being a witness to domestic violence, having police cars come past your house every single night, and you hearing those kinds of sirens. Those are things that create trauma in children.
We measure those by obtaining an ACE score, Adverse Childhood Experiences. It's on a scale of 10, and there are 10 ACEs. Typically, physical, emotional, sexual abuse, domestic violence, incarceration of a parent, mental illness of a parent, divorce, things like that. So those sort of determinants of health, social determinants of health, also have an impact on trauma in children.
If children are experiencing these things in their everyday lives, what does that look like in the classroom, in the way that they approach education? Mm-hmm.
It can be multiple ways. Mm-hmm. Those children who have developed some resiliency skills can be a normal child that doesn't act out, that can take the issues that face them and almost compartmentalize them and mm-hmm. say that those are the problems and we'll deal with those problems, but then I need to go on and live a normal life. Then other children who emotionally haven't been able to develop resiliency skills, act out. And that would be aggression in the schools or not paying attention.
So what's your plan? How will you approach this issue?
So part of our education is learning about the whole brain mm-hmm. and how the different traumas affect different parts of the brain, which regulates the behavior and the emotions. We don't want the teachers to re-traumatize the children, which is what's been happening for years and years. They're traumatized outside of school, then re-traumatized in school. And for many young people, particularly the African-American children in our community, they get suspended and expelled. Mm-hmm. And then you have the school-to-prison pipeline, and they end up in the juvenile center or in prison.
So one of the things that we hope we can affect change with is when a child acts out or when a child isn't paying attention, typically someone will say, "What's wrong with you?" And we want to change the culture to having people say, "Oh, what happened to you?" Because that is trauma thinking. So we're hoping to kind of flip the coin and have people honestly care about what happened to children. Do they care now? Yes. Do they always put two and two together and get four? No.
Lastly, what are your overall hopes for this project, and how do you think this will affect Indianapolis students?
Our hope is that we are able to not only work with the teachers and the children, but also inform parents and try to make a change in everybody that touches that child, change the culture of Indianapolis.
Thank you for coming in and for talking about this important issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana launched a new work requirement program through Medicaid in January. It's called Gateway to Work and is billed as a community engagement opportunity to help connect people with better employment opportunities. However, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports some worry the changes will result in Hoosiers losing health insurance.
Indiana was one of the first states to apply for and receive a federal waiver to implement work requirements for the state's Medicaid expansion program, HIP 2.0. Indiana's Gateway to Work launched at the beginning of this year. Jennifer Walthall is the state's Family and Social Services Administration's, or FSSA, secretary.
It's actually more about connecting people to things that they haven't been able to be connected to before.
Things like education and transportation. Indiana is only the second state to make the move, and the FSSA set a goal early in the process.
We're not going to lose people because of a reporting requirement or an administrative burden or something along those lines.
But many worry they will, and there is precedent for this worry. In Arkansas, the first state to implement similar requirements, more than 12,000 residents lost their health insurance. Many couldn't easily access the online-only reporting system. But Walthall says Indiana's system is easy and user-friendly, and not all online. Members can log work, volunteer, or school hours on computer, by phone, and in person, and they don't have to have documentation.
They'll just go in and say, "Hey, I volunteered for 20 hours this week, check," and it goes right through and gets the job done. We're not trying to make this a full-time job. We're actually trying to help people get real full-time jobs, and so we don't want to get in their way.
The state will work through existing workforce development programs to help people find better employment. Gateway to Work gives people a list of what it calls partners to help them find jobs or volunteer opportunities. So far, there are more than 200 listed on the website.
We would like to have a cohort of people that are looking for those who have been disenfranchised for a long time and help us do our job better. We can't do this by ourselves.
But some partners are skeptical. Maurice Young works with people relying on Medicaid. He's an advocate for people experiencing homelessness in Indianapolis. Every Wednesday, he hands out bagged lunches at the Central Library.
There you go. You're welcome.
He and his small team also help people navigate health care coverage for HIP 2.0 and other programs.
And then Keenan over there, he does Humana for people who don't know that there's extra benefits that they get after they're on it for a year.
Young feels like FSSA is relying too much on the partners who work with these communities.
And it's so funny because when you read through the presentation, the partners do the work, right? The partners are the ones supposed to find the volunteer opportunities. Okay, I can find volunteer opportunities, but how am I supposed to get them there? This is your program. Get them some bus tickets.
He'd rather see a carrot than a stick approach.
Just open it up and offer it, but don't require it as a quid pro quo for your health.
Not all recipients of HIP 2.0 are subject to the new work requirement restrictions. A majority of the more than 400,000 Hoosiers on HIP 2.0 will be exempt for a number of reasons, including age, medical frailty, substance use disorder, and homelessness. But Young says those categories aren't clear in real life. Homelessness is not clear.
Those institutions have different definitions of homelessness. So give me that information.
FSSA Secretary Jennifer Walthall knows it will be hard to reach every one of the estimated 70 to 80,000 people who may have to comply with the work changes. They've gone through partners, providers, and reached out directly to members through email or letters to get the word out.
The hardest folks to reach are the most important to reach.
Members aren't required to report any hours the first 6 months. The full 20-hour-a-week requirement won't be in place until 2020. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr.
Let's jump in and talk about some very important, sad topics, unfortunately very sobering to be sure. We are all very much aware of the opioid crisis in Northwest Indiana in particular, and in Lake County in particular, with the stats bear out the fact that there are too many addictions to begin with, too many overdose deaths to go along with all that too. Bring us up to date on how things are seem to shape up in Lake County and what kind of efforts that you and your colleagues at the Sheriff's Department are trying to do to deal with that and with the hopes of trying to kind of erase the crisis.
Right. Well, this morning we just finished a workshop with the session with the County Council where we got approved again the niche grant. That is strictly a heroin grant that's state and federally funded that Lake County Sheriff's Department has. We work in conjunction with other counties, Stark County, Porter County, LaPorte County, St. Joseph County, Jasper, and Newton County. So all the Northwest Indiana counties that we work along with, we've increased our patrols in narcotics investigation and in highway interdiction, where our interdiction officers have been seizing a number of opioids and heroin narcotics that's coming into Lake County from various parts of the nation.
Yeah, I know you worked very hard on that, and when you came back in as the sheriff, you worked very hard to make sure that those units were back on the street.
Absolutely,
again.
And I've been with the Sheriff's Department for 26 years, and that was my expertise, about 17 years in narcotics, and so I'm very passionate about that. And with the funding and the increased patrols, and that's just on the enforcement side. We've also dealt with programs inside our jail, the Vivitrol program that I discussed probably about a year ago.
Yeah,
and we have the judges involved, Judge Murphy, Judge Cantrell, in the meetings, working along with our outreach program as well, and mental health, and our doctors inside the jail, and identifying those that suffer with this addiction. So we have a treatment program as well inside our jail. The Vivitrol program is pretty much a shot. You have to qualify to be part of this program. You got to have you get screened and got to be pretty much evaluated that this is what you really want to do. You got to want to help yourself and want to change.
Mm-hmm.
And those people that are selected go through this program through detox, and just before going into the reentry program with our reentry personnel, this narcotic or this shot is given to you, the Vivitrol, which is free, taxpayer. It costs about $1,200 to $1,800 the shot, but we get that for free in our jail.
Wow.
And what that does, it blocks the opioid receptors in your brain, so you get no euphoria or anything for at least 30 days, which also helps with those suffering from alcohol addiction as well. So we're covering it on different bases and starting a program also with Dr. Mascal and our mental health, helping those that are seeking before they come and to commit a crime or anything, seeking help, that we provide that help to with resources and organizations that are partnering up with the Lake County Sheriff's Department to help them out.
How many approximately would you say of people that end up being incarcerated in the county jail come in already addicted, or maybe they may have gone through some treatment, but they've fallen off the wagon, so to speak?
Well, that is a large number that does come into our jail with not just opioid or heroin addiction, but alcohol addiction is large as well. That people
it's
go
just
through.
As big, or if not a bigger problem, I guess, in a way.
Exactly. We are dealing with that and also trying to develop with Dr. Mascal and other social workers more of a kind of in-house treatment where we separate those that have that addiction from the general population and do it more as a recovery program while they're in our jail. And those that are sentenced to, you know, 90, 120 a year, you know, time in our jail, 2 years, I think that will really help when we're just focusing on the recovery aspect of it.
Let's talk about the goals, the plans that you have for the Sheriff's Department, aside from what you've just mentioned here about about dealing with the opioid problem that you face at the county jail. How do things shape up for what you have planned for 2019?
Well, most importantly for 2019 is to get from under the Department of Justice oversight. Mm-hmm. We're pretty much there in compliance. They will do their next visit in the spring. I could tell you with the pay raises that we did for the correction officers, that is pretty much a 10% raise that we did within 3 years. So they were getting paid about just under $33,000 a year. So what happened was that there was a high turnover rate, hard to recruit correction officers to work in our facility or our organization. So what we did within the 3 years, next year will be the last year on their pay raise to get them up to $43,000, which is pretty much very close to the national average of correction officers. And we're starting to see it. We're getting a lot more candidates applying for the correction division. Our recruitment or retention has increased. So that's very important because that's one of the DOJ mandates is staffing. The other one is mental health. We're pretty much about there, about the hours and time that inmates dealing with mental health spend outside of the cell of time that's organized with them, structured and unstructured time. So we're pretty much there as well. So, you know, we're looking to professionalize the Lake County Sheriff's Department. Number one is always safety for my men and women in law enforcement and also for the citizens. We're conducting an RFP bid process for armored rescue vehicle. Mm-hmm. Currently, we have an old surplus of armored vehicle that's, you know, 1979. You know, that keeps breaking down on us. Well, it's time to evolve. The cost for that armored vehicle is about $360,000. But when you look at it in law enforcement equipment, that's pretty cheap. When you consider a garbage truck costs way more than that, an ambulance, a fire truck. And that is to keep, you know, our men and women in law enforcement safe. Also the citizens from any type of active shooter or high-risk warrants. I think we're one of the only sheriff's department or agencies that has a SWAT team that has a fully staffed medical staff, a doctor, medical personnel, nurses that come along with us on the SWAT team. So that rescue vehicle will also be a certified ambulance to be prepared to treat anybody with serious wounds, God forbid, in any type of active shooter situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, that's what you have to be able to, since you have to sell this basically to the county mm-hmm. council, since you're talking about such a high expense, you have to be able to show, I'm sure, that this thing is very multi-use vehicle, to
right.
be sure.
Yeah. And it's we did sell it to the county council, did approve it. It's now in the commissioner's hands. Mm-hmm. My understanding, it's not really costing taxpayers any money right now because it's we're hoping to get the funding through gaming. The profits through or the cut the proportions that we get through the gaming organizations. But nevertheless, I think the people, the citizens will see that this is money well spent, even if it was taxpayers' money. The commissioners have a role to do to make sure that what we're purchasing is not wasteful spending, regardless of where it's coming from. So I understand their role that we go through a bid process to make sure we get the best rescue vehicle that's out there and get what we paid for. So they have a responsibility as well to their citizens to make sure things are done right. So hopefully by this month, next month, God willing, everything goes well and we're able to get that crucial or important piece of equipment.
Now, you mentioned here just a moment ago when we were talking about the jail and about meeting the requirements for the federal Department of Justice to be able to get out of their supervision, mm-hmm. I guess, in a way, and things that you've had to improve at the jail. Salaries for your correction workers are one thing, to be mm-hmm. sure, make sure that the correctional officers and be able to keep the officers that, yes. that you have hired is one thing. So you're talking about basically a pay raise situation to help them out. And also, too, I know that you have come in on a regular basis to ask for raises for all of the staff members, including the people that work on the streets.
Yes.
What's the latest situation about that?
We spoke about also getting a pay increase with the qualified mental health professionals that we did last year. Mm-hmm. Again, is paying them based on their qualification and education and what the national average is. What we did today, again, in the council workshop, preparing for the council meeting next week, that you probably saw in the newspaper that the sheriff is asking for a 48% pay raise. When you really look at it.
That's in the headline. And
yes,
sure,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, it could be misleading, but what's going on is actually cost savings. What I did was cut about 8 positions from the sheriff's department, from the jail, and on the police side. So we're looking at a cost savings of over $100,000 to $150,000 in savings of cutting jobs that are not necessary. But the jobs that is necessary and using some of that money is you get what you pay for. So what we're doing is making sure that the bookkeepers, you know, when you're dealing with close to a $42 million budget, getting paid $25,000, $35,000 a year is just not going to cut it. Mm-hmm. So getting them up to close to the national average of the pay rate is what I'm doing. And most importantly, it's within my own budget. I'm not asking for additional appropriations. I'm actually saving money. Contracting out the food service with the jail is also saving a significant amount of money. And so at the end of the day, it's within my own budget. The money is based on the national average of what a citizen should get paid for, or an employee should get paid for the job that they're doing. And it's saving the taxpayers over $150,000. You know, you'll hear comments like, it must be nice to be a county employee to get these pay raises. Actually, it's not. The county civilian employees really don't get paid that much, and government pay overall mm-hmm. compared to the private sector. So, you know, we're just making sure, again, running a professional, efficient organization is number one.
In the time that we have left, Sheriff Martinez, let's talk a little bit about something that you're very much familiar with. You've spent a lot of your career, I know, literally being on the road mm-hmm. as a sheriff's deputy on the road, and you've come up through the ranks that way too. How are things doing for the officers, the sheriff's deputies, and the other people that have to be out there on road patrol as their jobs, basically, which you've had to do? How are they doing these days, and how are things shaping up to make life better for them, if you can?
Well, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. I know the morale is up. I've invested so much money in the patrol division, and they have equipment and training that they never had before. Right now, we've invested so much equipment in active shooter kits. That's ballistic vests that stops high-power rifles, ballistic helmets, patrol rifles. They've received a lot of the training for active shooters to deal with on a quarterly basis. We've also just yesterday I met with the Chief Sanchez of the Chicago Police Department Organized Crime, along with Undersheriff Parker of Cook County. So we've met with them yesterday to work alongside, partnering up with the multi-jurisdictional task force that we're going to create with our drug task force, our high crime unit, because crime has no boundaries. And a lot of crime bleeds over into Illinois, and a lot of crime bleeds over into Indiana. And we need to be working together because we're all investigating the same people, the same crime, and working together and having those contact informations to help each other is very important.
You probably find in having a chance, even though it's not very often, to meet with your fellow sheriffs, when you get to counties like Lake County that are on the corners of the state, we're talking mm-hmm. about, in this case, the northwest corner. You've got, of course, in southwest Indiana as well, too, around Evansville. Mm-hmm. All of the corner counties tend to have the most problems because you have more states where the instances of crimes happen, and you've right. got that flow of criminals that can come either way, and it's very difficult to deal with that, I imagine.
Yes, yes, it is. And I'm proud of our department and how we evolved. We are a very specialized department with an aviation unit, a canine unit, a narcotic unit, and a marine unit, SWAT division, warrant division. I mean, this is right now, I would say this is the best place to be in law enforcement. So many opportunities and making a big difference here in the community, and I'm committed to that.
Well, Sheriff Martinez, we'll have to leave it at that for now, and we hope to have you back to talk again soon. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here. Thanks.
We've been talking here in studio with Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez Jr. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.